My guest today, Matt Stoller, has a long history in Democratic and liberal politics. He has worked for several Democratic candidates and affiliated groups and has personally raised millions of dollars for Democrats online. He also admits having aggressively opposed Nader-style challenges in 2008. He was an early advisor to Act Blue, a progressive PAC which processed over $300 million of Democratic candidates. He has worked in Congress mostly on the Dodd-Frank financial reform package. He was previously a producer at MSNBC and now is a regular columnist for Salon.com. Welcome, Matt Stoller, to Takes on the World.
Hey, thanks.
Glad to have you here. We have been repeatedly told, or more precisely warned by the mainstream media, that 5 weeks from yesterday, President Obama and the Democrats need to have a meeting of their minds and reach an agreement on budget cuts with congressional Republican leaders, or otherwise, U.S. economy is likely to go over a fiscal cliff and into further recession, if not immediately down the line. And for some time, there have been strong hints that the president will be willing to take a knife to Medicare and Medicaid and even modify Social Security eligibility to reach an agreement. And after reading your article on October 27th, Salon.com, the progressive case against Obama, it would seem that those hints accurately foretell the future. Is that your take on it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not clear like what exactly the final deal will be, but I think it's pretty clear that what will happen, whatever the deal is increasing economic and political inequality.
Well, I'll tell you. Yes, go on.
Well, I suspect. I mean, you know, you can the details. Like they're going to change the definition of inflation probably, which will end up cutting Social Security benefits and raising taxes on middle class, but they may not end up doing that. They may end up cutting Medicaid or Medicare. They do want to reduce corporate taxes. They're going to play around with the details, but you can be assured that the deal won't be a particularly good one for people like us. And it will be probably pretty good for people who are very wealthy.
Well, one of the things that jumps off the page, and you emphasize in your article, which I recommend everybody read from October 27th, Salon.com, is that under Obama, not only has the divergence, the inequality in our economic reality widened to unprecedented levels, it has been institutionalized. And perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, so what's interesting about inequality is that the real way to get rid of it, I mean, is to let the markets crash. The rich kind of take care of inequality themselves because they build an unstable financial system using more and more debt and leverage. Then eventually it all collapses. And that means when it all collapses, you know, the poor don't have any money and the rich do. So the rich lose, you know, what losses there are taken out by the rich. What's important about that, the context of a crash, is what happens afterwards. Because the policies that are adopted to mitigate what happened during the crash dictate the shape of the society that comes. And that's why in the 1929 stock market crash, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt implemented a series of programs to force down debt held by normal people, it created a much more egalitarian society for the next 50 years or so. With Obama, what you saw is the bailouts were a way of saying to the wealthy who had lost a fair amount of money, you're going to be made whole. And the foreclosure crisis, which was also a policy choice by the Obama administration, was a way of saying to everyone else, you will not be made whole. And so during the Bush administration, when there was economic growth of roughly 65 cents of every dollar went to the top 1%, during the Obama administration, when there's economic growth, roughly 93 cents of every dollar goes to the top 1%. So the Obama administration has actually created a society in which the gains are more unequally distributed than the Bush administration. And this was You know, this is clearly done through policy choices. But another thing that I just noticed is that tax rates on the wealthy are not the ones that are in the law, but the de facto ones are actually going down and have been going down throughout the Obama administration, because more and more wealthy have been shifting their income from ordinary income to capital gains, and capital gains is taxed at a lower rate. So, you know, there's all sorts of ways that this is happening, but in the net outcome of the policy choices, what you're seeing is a more unequal society.
There doesn't seem to be any mention of taxing capital gains in all these discussions back and forth that you hear on the mainstream media or read in the mainstream media. Where is this?
Well, that's right. I mean, and I think another, you know, and I think another issue here, and this is where I differ from most sort of people on the traditional left, is that it is Obama's responsibility, and it is Obama's goal to increase inequality. And that's, you know, he is, he believes in what Bush believed in, which is a technocratic elite that deserves a gain from the society that they manage. And that's, you know, he's a bad guy, and the people that surround him are bad people. And they are corrupt. And I'm not sure what kind of laws they're breaking, because laws don't seem to matter anymore. But this is a serious problem for people who believe in social justice, because you have to figure out a strategy to actually implement a more socially just society. While most of the Democratic Party believes in this guy who is, you know, who's essentially a kind of low-rent authoritarian.
Well, one of the things that jumped off the page to me and to answer all those who would argue with you was you write that during the transition itself, I'm quoting, Bush's Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson offered a deal to Barney Frank, who's just retired from Congress, that would to force banks to write down mortgages and stem foreclosures if Barney would speed up the release of TARP money. Paulson demanded as a condition of the deal that Obama sign off on it. Barney said fine, but to his surprise, the incoming president vetoed the deal. This is something I'm sure most of our listeners are not aware of, and most of those who voted for Obama are not aware of, certainly the people who lost their homes.
Right. I mean, you know, when you're talking about the housing crash, you know, you're talking about $5 to $7 trillion of home equity, which is just savings by the middle class, just gone. And home equity is the difference between the amount that you of asset, your asset value in your home, and the debt. So you can increase home equity by increasing the asset value, which would be a bubble, or you can reduce the debt, which would be, you know, a debt write down. And the Bush administration was willing to do a debt write down for the middle class so that they could release the TARP money faster. And this was offered to Barney Frank, and as long as he could get Obama to go along during the transition. And Obama said no. And he said no because his economic team did not believe in debt relief for the middle class. They don't think that the middle class should have access to the same political and legal rights that the wealthy do. There's really no other way to put it. That's just who they are. It's kind of authoritarianism or you know, it's kind of banana republic America style. You know, they wear nice suits and they, you know, go to elite schools and they're multi different races and stuff like that. And but they ultimately pursue the same policies and using a lot of the same methods with maybe better PR.
Well, there certainly was shock at the time, immediately after Obama came into office, in which he appointed the very foxes who had raided the chicken coop, beginning with Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, and so on, brought them into the White House as economic team. Nobody forced him to do that, at least that we know about. There may have been deals made ahead of time, but one of the things that I had believed was one of the reasons Obama was selected to be the president was that he could get away with bailing out the banks in Wall Street, whereas a Republican candidate like McCain, whose backers love Wall Street but whose base hates it, would have had a harder time selling it to the American people. And whereas Obama had absolutely no problem at all, other than we had a Tea Party arising, but certainly his backers, supporters, accepted it lying down. And the prospect of him doing anything in this next 4 years, I don't think you have much of expectations in that.
Well, he won't do anything, but I mean, my belief, well, look, you know, the guy as a state senator, you know, from what I heard, and I don't have this locked down, but, you know, this is what people in Chicago say, like what he was doing is he was essentially helping, you know, billionaires gentrify an area. And that's what his kind of career was. And those billionaires helped him, you know, the Penny Pritzker types, they helped him, you know, his whole political career. I mean, this guy has been consistent in his, you know, neoliberal outlook. But I would say over the next 4 years, I mean, I don't, obviously you can't predict the future, but if I were to make a sort of a observation about what I think will happen, I mean, I think like the Obama administration, you know, one of the things people don't quite realize is they're fairly incompetent. Like they're not particularly good at governing. You saw that with Benghazi. They're just not that good at stuff. So, you know, they're very PR focused. And so people think they're brilliant because they keep saying they're brilliant. They're not actually good at the work of governing a country. So what will happen is that over the next 3 years, eventually the media will turn on Obama, and you're going to see a kind of collapse in support as sort of something like Katrina happens, where the inability to actually manage a situation is revealed, and a speech doesn't fix it, and it's not an election, and it's not something that has to do with immediate self-preservation. And you will see a similar to what you saw with Bush in the last 3 years, where people just hated him and he was at 30% approval ratings and everybody, you know, he became a joke. I think you could see something like that with the Obama administration. But fundamentally, I mean, I haven't fixed anything, and we have a pretty fragile set of institutions to deal with some fairly profound challenges.
Well, my guest is Matt Stoller. We're talking about the progressive case against Obama and its implications for the next 4 years, the article he wrote in Salon.com on October 27. There are those who defended Obama saying, well, it's a system. He has to deal with the Republicans, and he has to deal with all the limitations of power that any president has to experience. But you point out that the great inequalities that he enshrined and institutionalized occurred mostly under his first 2 years, when he had the Democrats running both the Senate and the House.
Yeah, I mean, during the election, you know, they sort of, I thought that the 2012 election was a sort of a disgrace for everyone involved, most of the media and the Democratic elites and the Republicans. You know, it was a terrible election for honesty. And the reason is because there was this sort of, you know, the Obama administration ran on the idea that the Republicans were stopping them from doing all the great things they wanted to do, and people sort of got rid of the idea that there was a Democratic Congress from 2009 and 2010, but there was, and it was just indisputable that there was overwhelming Democratic majorities, and they enacted a bunch of significant policies, the stimulus, Obamacare, Dodd-Frank. And then before that, there was a working Democratic majority for things like TARP and the bailout of Fannie and Freddie. I mean, they had a lot of power, and they implemented policies that were very significant. They just didn't work. And, you know, they sort of put down the memory hole that they ever had any political power. So they can be like, well, don't blame me, we tried. But they didn't try. They succeeded at implementing the policies they wanted to. They just weren't very good policies. Well, I mean, they were good for the rich. They just weren't good for, you know, any of us.
Well, there are the critics of Obamacare have pointed out that it's largely a gift to private insurance companies, and that even at the time of the elections, some polls showed that single payer was supported by some 70% of the American public. That was immediately taken off the table. And Obama and his administration fiercely protected the rights of the insurance companies to get their share. this is
yeah,
hard.
I don't know. You know, I don't know. I'm not an expert in healthcare, so I'm not going to speak to that. I don't generally believe that Obama administration programs are going to work, but I can't speak to Obamacare specifically.
Getting back to the economic situation, back what happened, you point out that the bailouts and the associated Federal Reserve actions were not primarily shifts of funds to the bankers. They were guaranteed that property rights for a certain class of creditors were immune from the challenge of market forces. And you write, the foreclosure crisis with its rampant criminality, predatory lending, and document forgeries represents the flip side. Property rights for debtors simply increasingly exist solely at the pleasure of the powerful. And then you go on to point out the lack of a prosecution of Wall Street executives. We've seen a number of like second-rate players, pictures in the New York Times business section, but none of the major players have appeared there.
Right. I mean, the way to look at the problem is to see it less as a kind of they got money and more as a they are super citizens. And so every time there is they commit some sort of fraudulent act that would send you or me to jail, they just make money at it. And that's a sort of red type. That's like a... Yeah, I mean, they're just an aristocracy where they can kind of pillage what they want. And that's why it's a continuing policy choice. It's not just TARP or the Federal Reserve bailouts or the Fannie and Freddie bailout or anything. It was an entire scope, and it still is the framework of the administration. For instance, the SEC right now tends to, when they find wrongdoing, they don't prosecute. They just settle. They don't prosecute individuals usually. They don't prosecute companies. They just settle. And they don't even settle effectively. They just say to the company, you have to pay us some money, but you don't have to admit wrongdoing. And so the companies are now looking at the SEC as an agency which gives out parking tickets. And they just build it into the cost of doing business. So they can commit all sorts of terrible acts if they want to. And they just have to pay a modest fine for it because the policy of the SEC and most of our regulatory agencies at this point is to not actually hold anyone accountable for what they've done wrong if they belong to a certain economic class. And that is the legacy of the Bush and Obama administration.
Well, my guest again is Matt Stoller of Salon.com. One of the things I found interesting is you speak in your article about the shape of the system Obama has designed, that it is the modern American order has a certain equilibrium, the kind of we identify in Middle Eastern resource extraction-based economies. And you're pointing to the fact that there's a transition, what appears of the American economic order toward a petro-state. And by some accounts, and I've read them myself, America will become the largest producer of hydrocarbons in the world, larger than Saudi Arabia. And this is, as I say, I have read this myself elsewhere in the economic sections, but this seems to have been ignored by those who have supported Obama and by the progressive movement in general.
Well, right. I mean, the projections that U.S. will be number one in hydrocarbon production, you know, I've heard it's an interesting problem because I've heard that they're sort of not accurate. I mean, they're just trying to sort of I don't know. But there's sort of a lot of fraud in the numbers, apparently. But undeniably, the United States is investing huge sums of money into the dirtiest forms of energy, far more than was common in terms of investment in the 90s or 80s, and more than was invested during the Bush administration, tar sands, and fracking. And it's having an impact. I mean, America is becoming a very significant player in terms of producing oil and natural gas again. And so for a president who, you know, promised to do something about global warming and then did this, it's a real turnaround. But also, the economics of a country that makes a lot of its economic production from hydrocarbons, you know, the politics of that is pretty frightening, and it tends, not always, but it tends to create a far more centralized, highly economically disparate, oligarchical set of structures. A lot of policing, a lot of military force, not a lot of manufacturing, not a broad middle class, but really a kind of, you know, a Middle Eastern style economy, economic structure where there are a small group of people who control everything and own most of the resources and wealth and political power. And then you have everyone else who's in, you know, relatively disempowered and has limited access to food and transportation and healthcare and all the rest, and just mass poverty. And that's where we're heading. That's the Obama economy.
The Obama economy, and yet, when you brought this issue up, you debated Daniel Ellsberg, who ironically is one of the leading defenders of Bradley Manning, and you were defending, he was defending his jailer, so to speak. What was Ellsberg?
Yeah, no, it's funny. Daniel Ellsberg wrote a piece where he said that Obama should be impeached, but first you had to reelect him because Romney was so dangerous. And, you know, I thought that was kind of amusing. But, you know, I have a lot of respect for Daniel Ellsberg. He's a very brave person, and he speaks out. But, you know, to me, when I looked at Obama and looked at Romney, I didn't see a lot of differences. Not that they aren't different people. Not that they wouldn't pursue different policies. They might. But you just don't know because Obama has been such a terrible president, and Romney didn't look that much worse. And having an aroused Democratic Party opposing the president would actually stop some of the more horrific policies that Romney would pursue, but not necessarily stop the policies that Obama would pursue because Democrats don't oppose their own president. And that was the gist of the argument. But Daniel Ellsberg, you know, didn't agree, and most people didn't agree. But it was worth making that argument because it's time for, I think, people to stop giving Obama a pass on the things that he does.
Now, the AFL-CIO, the labor bureaucracy, has long been a part and parcel of Democratic Party. And they, of course, put millions of dollars into electing Democrats and Obama. But what did Obama do for the labor movement for American workers in his first 4 years?
Well, I mean, if you look at, there was one, so deunionization was not quite as fast as it was during the Reagan administration, but it was pretty fast. The country deunionized faster under Obama than under Bush. So it's hard to say that he's a particularly pro-union president. And they're not commenting on the Walmart tickets. The White House isn't. So it's hard to say that this guy supports labor, even though a lot of labor unions do support him. I don't understand it. I mean, I really don't get it. I guess I do. There's a sort of cynical calculation the insiders know this about Obama, but they can't really admit it to themselves. And then it's so painful to sort of strike out on your own and to be intellectually honest about what's going on. And it hurts your career to do it. Most of the people on television are on television because they either lie or they're actively, they participate in their own ignorance around these questions. I mean, when you come out and you say the things that I'm saying, you know, your ratings go down because Democrats don't want a bummer. And in a lot of ways, we're in a sort of post-truth society, which is very disturbing. Things that can't go on, like the system that we live in, won't go on. Which isn't to say things will get better. They will probably end up getting worse, but they won't be the same. So there's that.
Well, with this line, you're certainly not likely to be invited on MSNBC.
Well, no. I mean, MSNBC is, you know, it's owned by Comcast and General Electric. and the people that they have on MSNBC are, you know, they have a very specific job, which is to justify the Democratic policy framework to Democrats watching MSNBC. That's what they're supposed to do. They're not supposed to do journalism. They're not supposed to do reporting. They're not supposed to, you know, host debates. Their job is to sell bad policy to Democrats. And they do it, and they do a pretty good job. Because if you look at it, Democrats tend to like what Democratic elites are doing, even though when you ask them about specifics, they say, oh, well, I don't like that, I don't like that, I don't like that. And, you know, but I love that the I love what the Democrats are doing, even though it's all the things I don't like.
One thing I want to get into, but you did bring up in the article, and so people will say, particularly women, that they voted for Obama on the basis of his position on women's issues as opposed to those of Romney and the Republican Party. And you quote someone in there, Falguni Sheff, who I'm not familiar with, who argued that this was a perspective of a privileged white woman who ignores much of the impact that Obama's policies have had on women, specifically women of color. Perhaps you could comment on that.
Well, you know, you should have her on the show, and she's great. But I mean, I think, you know, the basic argument is, it's probably, I mean, I think it's undeniably true that women, you know, just in the reproductive rights area, that the Democrats are better on that than the Republicans, and that Obama would probably be better than that on Romney, although, you know, Romney did say that he wasn't going to propose any changes to abortion laws, and he, one of his big funders was the maker of contraceptives for women, so it seems like it's unlikely he would try to restrict that simply out of self-interest. But regardless, I don't think you can dispute that it's better to elect Democrats for reproductive rights. But there's a whole series of questions around economic equity that are ignored. So the predatory lending disproportionately impacts women. The fastest group of prisoners by demographics are women. The foreclosure crisis has disproportionately impacted women. 1.6 million women are now in poverty who weren't in poverty when Obama took office. You have terrible impacts on women from the drug war. Immigration, detention, the deportations, which are at a record under the Obama administration, tears apart families and has huge and deleterious effects on women. And then there's all the foreign policy, you know, issues of wars and drones and so on and so forth. And I think by saying, well, women's issues have to do with simply reproductive rights, I think you really cheapen the question of what women care about. It's not, it's much broader than reproductive rights. But on reproductive rights, you know, Obama's not that great. You know, on Plan B, he said that he wouldn't allow, he overruled scientists at the FDA who wanted to allow young women to get Plan B contraceptives because he said, well, I'm a father of two girls, so I understand, you know, parents' concerns. And it's like, well, you understand parents' concerns who are, who don't rape their children, but there are parents who rape their children, and those children shouldn't have to ask permission from their parents to get Plan B contraceptive. And that happens, and it's something that people don't like to talk about because it's horrible, but it happens, and the policy implications of what Obama did left those people out. And there are a variety of things that that Obama has done. The Hyde Amendment, which he institutionalized into Obamacare. I mean, you can talk about Roe versus Wade, and that's obviously a very significant court case. But the Hyde Amendment, you know, is about the money to pay for abortion. If you're rich, you can get an abortion because of Roe v. Wade. If you're poor and you're on Medicaid and you can't afford to get an abortion because Medicaid doesn't pay for it or because, you know, what's going to happen in 2014 with Obamacare won't pay for it, then, you know, you're not, effectively, you don't live in a pro-choice country. And that's something that
Matt, I hate to stop it right there because we've come to the end of a very interesting interview and with even more to go. I want to thank you very much for being our guest. How can people find your work?
I'm on Twitter on Matthews, at Matthew Stoller, MATTHEWSTOLLER. Or you can go to MattStoller.com.
MattStoller.com. Thank you, Matthew Stoller, for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye.